Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. It has been a head-spinning few days in Syria. After the astonishing collapse of the House of Assad, there's an equally dizzying array of questions which Syrians, not to mention the rest of us, need to confront. Whether the country will submit to the chaos and instability that has subsumed other Arab countries whose rulers were toppled, or whether the promise of a more open democratic government will vanish in the grip of another authoritarian leader. On that front, there appear at least to be some initially encouraging noises from the main Islamist rebel group in Syria, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. They say that they've granted an amnesty to all army conscripts and that they've had a meeting with the outgoing prime minister about a transfer of power to an interim figure, Mohammed al-Bashir, while underlining, they say, the need to benefit from the experience of those who have been running the country. In the even shorter term, there's also the question about the country's network of notorious prisons where tens of thousands of political detainees disappeared under the dictatorship of the Assads. Families have been streaming towards the jails in the hope of finding their relatives now that the doors have been prized open. The most feared prison of them all was Sadnaya, near Damascus. Our first report today is from there, with our correspondent in Syria, Barbara Plett-Usher.
I'm about 30 kilometres outside of Damascus by one of the main prison complexes. It's called Sadnaya, and I can see two prisons in the distance on a hill. The one to the right is the main prison. There, HTS freed the inmates already. The one to the left is called the Red Prison, and there it's believed that some prisoners are still locked in cells underground, and there is a stream of people walking up the hill towards it.
Sadnaya is a symbol for some of the darkest abuses of Bashar al-Assad's rule. Thousands of opposition supporters were tortured and killed here. Now there's a stampede of family members taking the chance of finding those still missing. Everyone has a desperate story to tell of loved ones jailed for years. Munzir Tarki is looking for his brother-in-law.
I know my experience with the Syrian regime. Since more than 13 years, I've lost a lot of my friends in prisons. But I think we could. I don't know. We pray for that. We try. We are trying to find him in everywhere. We're asking everyone. We came to here like everyone.
Call me the wounded mother, says this woman, because of the children she's lost. May God take revenge on Bashar.
We're climbing the hill now to reach the top where the prisons are, joining that long stream of people who are also doing the same, wanting to find out if the search efforts in the prison are going to turn up any people still locked up there.
Just days ago, rebels freed thousands of prisoners here on their march to Damascus, but many believe others are still trapped in underground cells. The Syrian civil defense group, the White Helmets, has joined the search. We spoke with one of its volunteers.
Based on the information we've gathered, we believe there's a network of cells with prisoners beneath the jail. But we haven't yet been able to find the entrance. We don't have any details on how many people are underground, but we were informed of this by others.
We've just pressed into the prison. We came in a real crush because there was this sudden belief that they had found the entrance to the underground prison. But it looks like it's been a false alarm.
They're searching the bowels of the prison, looking for tunnels that lead to hidden cells, pounding away at the earthen floor. Frantic efforts to break through to anyone who might still be alive. Elsewhere, men sift through a litter of documents for any evidence of their loved ones or clues to the underground prison. Many are convinced it exists, but there are some doubts, including from a prisoner support group. Outside, an older woman with a steady gaze, Umm al-Abid, tells me she's looking for her son. She used to visit him in prison, but then he was moved. After the past 2 weeks, Syria has entered a new era, but she is still caught in the dark grip of the old one.
Our priority is our sons, who are the future of this country. Do you believe that we, the elderly, can do much now? We want our boys back. We want our country back, too.
How can this country move forward without dealing with the horrors of its past?
Barbara Pletosha reporting from us from just by Sirtanaya prison near Damascus. Omar al-Shoghri survived 3 years inside Syria's prisons, including Sirtanaya. For the past 9 years, he's been living in exile in Sweden. His is a barely comprehensible story of abuse and escape. You'll hear about that in a moment. But first, as Omar has been telling my colleague Celia Hatton, he spent the past 24 hours pretty much non-stop watching videos online of men and women running free from Syrian prisons.
It's insane how happy a human being could be in such a short time. I mean, despite all the suffering we've been through for 14 years, yet last 24 hours have been insane of how much I laughed, how much I was smiling. My cheeks, you know, my cheeks, they hurt very bad. There is no moment more beautiful than the moment you see your country being liberated from a dictator that's been in charge with his father for over 50 years. There's no moment more hopeful than seeing political prisoners who never believed that we'll see freedom again, running out of prison free.
Tell us your story. How long were you in Syrian prisons?
Well, my story starts as a very happy, lovely boy who was severely in love at the age of 15. Then I was taken to prison for doing nothing, literally nothing. And I was taken to prison and I was tortured and I was forced to give false confession. And then later I was sentenced to execution. And I spent 3 years in prison. I was, like all other political prisoners, tortured on a daily basis, starved. We were sitting in rooms where the guard would come sometimes and say, hey, you got to choose one of you to be executed. So we as cellmates, we had to discuss between each other who is willing to die tomorrow, who is willing to sacrifice their life for others. And that wasn't always an easy question to do in our cells. You know, my cellmates were killed on a daily basis, and I was lucky to survive after 3 years because I have the most incredible, strong, fabulous, beautiful mother on this planet. She managed to smuggle me on my execution day, talking about luck. And then I made it out, and I met my mom, hugged her for the first time. It felt unique.
Omar, tell me about that day. So you thought you were heading towards your execution? What exactly happened?
They announced me for execution on a Tuesday in 2015 in June. And then for 2 days, they put me in a room to prepare me. And then after 2 days, they put me somewhere and they loaded their guns and they aimed. And I was on the ground. So my head is on the ground. I don't see anything. I close my eyes as strong as I can. I hold strong to my stomach to not feel the pain. And then they said, shoot. And they shot. I thought I died, and it doesn't hurt, so that's great. And, you know, after 3 years of torture, I believed if I die, I go to heaven. There's no way being as an innocent tortured for 3 years, then go to hell. Doesn't make sense, logically, to anyone. So I thought I would go to heaven. So when I woke up, I stand, and then I see a tree. You know, I dreamed of seeing a tree again. We were under the ground for years. I see a tree, I see a flower, I see a bird flying, and I see color. You know, I missed color. I missed color so much. And I see color, I see blue, I see the sky, I see the sun. It's fabulous. So I really believed it was heaven. And then a car stopped next to me and ordered me to sit in the car. I sit and they drop me 30 minutes later. And then things get so crazy. I don't understand what's happening. 10 days later, I was between my mother's hands.
So you were taken for execution. They didn't kill you. How did you get out? Was it your mother had a hand in this?
It was a mock execution. My mom bribed everything in the system from the top to the bottom. So even the execution guards were bribed and the head of the prison and everyone was bribed.
What was it like in those prisons? Can you describe how you and the other prisoners survived day to day?
You don't survive because you're strong physically or mentally. You survive because you have cellmates that care about you. They care about to bring you your food when you can't bring it because your arms are broken. Carrying you to the bathroom when your legs are broken under torture. That's how you survive. And you need to have hope in something. But the guards are very aware of the fact that we need hope. So they try to break our hope as much as they can. That's why they They make us cellmates torture each other. And the guards come in inside Naya prison, where they're trying to rescue people today. The guard would come, tells you, wake up, then you wake up. Then tells guard, ask you, how many dead bodies do you have in your room? Then you tell them, they take the dead bodies and they torture some people. But the breakfast or the food, because there's only one meal. The food comes, doesn't mean that you can eat. You hold the food in your hand after sharing it between everyone else. And then if the guard forgets to say eat, you're not allowed to eat. And if you eat, that could lead to execution of many people, because the guard has no limit in the number of people they could kill. During the day, at any moment of the day, the guard could come in for torture. I don't want to traumatize your audience more now that the dictator has fallen and now we're free. But this doesn't mean that we won't be asking for justice. People have died. Thousands of people have died. My cousins who were arrested with me died under torture. My friends, thousands of them died in prison. And then my father and my brothers were killed outside, and my school was bombed, and the girl I loved, they bombed her house. You know, those people cannot just go, escape to Russia. They need to be held accountable for their crimes.
Omar, tell us, though, about the men who sat in prison cells alongside you. You've said that they helped you survive. Who were these men? Can you describe some of them, some of the people you left behind?
My cellmates have been always during my time in prison, the best people of my country, the highly educated people, the doctors, engineers, psychologists, lawyers, teachers. None of them was a criminal or anything. They all political prisoners. The doctor was at some point taking care of my wounds, so the psychologist talking about me with me about how to take care of our daily trauma, and the teacher how to improve our grammar. A lawyer talking about how can we build a dictator-free prison so prisoners don't become dictators and want to kill others for them to survive. And then suddenly you sit in the best environment possible to learn anything you want to learn about the world. In that small cell, people cared, people trusted each other, people helped each other. There were days where I could not use my hands and they would bring me my food. And you have to remember, this prisoner who was bringing you food is starved almost to death and wants to eat anything if they could. And yet they keep my food in their hands and they feed me. So those people are the people we're talking about that has been freed in the last few days. And many of them are still under the ground. We're trying to find right now. The regime in Syria have tried to keep down and torture and kill the top people in our country. But now this is over.
The remarkable story of Omri al-Shogri, now living in Sweden, but on the ordeal that he suffered inside Syria. He was speaking to my colleague Celia Hatton here on NewsHour. Coming up the programme, we'll hear from the family of the American journalist Austin Tice, who was abducted in Syria more than a decade ago, and whom they believe is still alive. They're calling for his release.
If they have the power to do so, now's the time. Anyone, absolutely anyone there that has the ability to do so, we are just begging them to take advantage of this and reunite the family.
That interview with Austin's sister, Abby, coming up in about 20 minutes. Our main headlines this hour, the victorious Syrian rebel leader Abu Muhammad al-Jalani has met the ousted regime's prime minister to coordinate the transfer of power. The insurgents have issued an amnesty for Syrian army conscripts. And several European countries have suspended their asylum programs for Syrians following the downfall of President Assad. More on that in just a couple of minutes. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. The scenes at the borders between Syria and its neighbour in the west, Lebanon, and its neighbour to the south, Jordan, show huge throngs waiting to cross. And this is the thing, they're waiting to cross into Syria after the 13 years of war, which saw more than half the Syrian population displaced. Thousands are now pouring back into the country. Most refugees are, as ever, in those neighbouring countries, but there's also a vast diaspora of migrants across the world. And for many, while there's been agony and heartache over the manner in which they had to flee Syria in the first place, there are also big questions about when, maybe even whether, they should think about returning to a possibly chaotic, possibly insecure homeland. Added to the complexity of calculations is the news today that many European countries have now suspended the handling of asylum applications from Syrians. More on that specifically in a few minutes. But first, my NewsHour colleague James Kumarasamy has been speaking to some Syrian emigres here in London, starting with one man who grew up in Damascus but has lived in West London almost as long as the Assad family has been in power.
My name is Mohammed Haytham Yasir. I was a chef for almost 40 years. I arrived to this country in 1977.
So when you left Syria, it was the father, Hafez, who was ruling the country.
The main tyrant, the main one.
So we were just given a very tasty, lovely, sweet baklava. Pastry.
That's the baklava.
It's very nice. And sweets for a sweet day for you?
Exactly. You can't imagine. You've been under... The worst occupation is when you are occupied by your own people.
People are looking at what has happened. It's been so quick, this end to the Assad regime, and they are wondering about what comes next and who the people are that are going to be in power. What are your thoughts about what's going to come next?
We waited 54 years. At least give us 50 days, it will be better. 100%.
You just come down the road and... The supermarket here called Damask Gate. It's got a wide variety of fruit and veg outside. Inside, some rather luscious smelling Syrian delicacies. And managing director, also originally from Damascus, is called Maha.
We are happy. We finished long term of dictator regime. But we have some concern about the people who come to power now.
You say you're concerned. Are you worried about who has led this these troops that have come into Damascus? Is that your concern?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because he is still considered a terrorist in the West.
But for us, they are not terrorists. They are part of the population. I have some people here working to the company. They are planning to go back after maybe 2 or 3 months till the thing settle in there.
Are any of them in the shop now?
One of them, he didn't turn up today because one of his brother was a prisoner there.
So he's helping the family to look?
Yeah.
We did meet one young Syrian working there. He's called Ayman. He said he arrived in Britain 2 years ago and his asylum claim is still being processed. With Maha's help translating, and before the government announced it was pausing Syrian asylum claims, I asked him whether he was worried that something like that might happen.
No. He said, no, it's okay, we hope Syria will be better, and it doesn't matter if it's affect his case or not, yeah, because at the end he wants to go back. He's afraid to be there like a war, a game, civil war.
Because you have direct experience. Your brother died in the civil war, is that correct?
Yeah, he said his brother was died in the prison, and he hopes so that's it's gonna be okay. Civil war gonna happen in there again. So he's waiting.
And that was Syrian shop worker Ayman speaking to NewsHour's James Kumarasamy alongside Maher, just down the road from us here in the BBC studios in London. As I mentioned, a lot of European countries have said that they won't for the moment continue to process asylum applications from Syrians. Among those countries are Britain, as we just heard, also France and Germany, which hosts a million Syrians. One of the first countries to announce it was suspending applications was Austria, and it's thinking of repatriating those already in the country. Jaffa Bambuk is originally from Aleppo. He has Austrian citizenship, having lived in Austria for the last 10 years. What does he make of the announcement?
Considering the announcement, the news was not surprising in itself. Many European far-right and right-wing conservative parties, including those in Austria, have wanted to normalize relations with Assad, at least since the spring, in order to send refugees back to Syria. In this respect, the aim of today's reports is nothing new. Asylum procedures have already been gradually made more difficult, family reunifications in particular.
And in terms of whether you think it is justified or not, I mean, I guess, you know, there are two ways of looking at it. One is that, you know, we don't quite know what sort of new Syria is going to emerge. But I guess from the other point of view, they may think that, well, you know, it's time now for those who have said that they were fleeing Assad's repression to go back.
I mean, as I mentioned, the news was not surprising, but my goodness, talk about bad timing. Syrians have just begun to be happy about bringing down a 50-year-old dictatorship, but now they have to deal and think about what will happen to themselves and their families and their legal status. And yes, look, there are perhaps Syrians who are thinking about a possible return, but the question of whether all Syrian refugees can be sent back to Syria is not a subjective one. It is about a political and legal judgment that needs to be made by all European countries as to whether Syria is a safe country or not. And this is a judgment that cannot be made within a day after the fall of the regime, especially because it is unclear what will happen in Syria at the moment, what fighting will still take place, what form of state will evolve in the future.
Are you hearing or have you managed to speak to anybody who may be caught up in this?
Not particularly. I mean, many people who are in Austria at the moment, there are around 95,000 Syrians in Austria. Not all of them are concerned with this issue, of course, but especially people who have come here in the last 2 or 3 years are concerned and are worried about their future. What will happen? Will they have to go back after they've just arrived here?
Does it make you reconsider, you know, your life in Austria that you say that this feels like it's a move which isn't in the best interests of all Syrians?
I mean, me personally, not at all. I am planning to stay in Austria and to keep up with my studies. The thing about European right-wing parties, the Austrian ones in particular, is that they want to seize the moment and play up the issue in the media at the moment. And they do not necessarily care about Assad's dictatorship being down. They've done nothing to help with that. As I mentioned, they've wanted to normalize their relations with him just a couple of months ago.
Jaffa Bambouk, a citizen of Austria, an emigre from Syria. He was speaking to me from Vienna. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. We're just going to step for a moment away from Syria because there's been what seems to be a big development in the investigation into the killing last week of the top US health insurance executive, Brian Thompson. He was killed last week in New York. The police have just announced that they've arrested a 26-year-old man called Luigi Mangione. Our correspondent Neda Torfik in New York is following the story for us.
Well, Luigi Mangione is a 26-year-old. He was born and raised in Maryland, but his last known address was in Hawaii. He went to school in Pennsylvania, and he was actually found because an employee at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania, which is a town more than 4 hours' drive outside of New York, that employee had really connected him to those widely circulated images that police put out of the suspected gunman after the shooting. So that employee at the McDonald's alerted local authorities. And according to officials here, when Mr. Mangione was approached by police, local police, he acted suspiciously. They started questioning him, and they found that he was carrying multiple fraudulent IDs as well as a U.S. passport. And one of those IDs was actually the same New Jersey license that was used by the suspected gunman when he checked into a hostel on the Upper West Side before the shooting. They say after kind of further investigation, He had other items on him that connected him with the incident, including a ghost gun that was made with a 3D printer, a three-page handwritten manifesto that showed ill will towards corporate America, and also a mask and clothing they said that was consistent with what the suspected gunman was wearing.
Okay. And he's still being described as a person of interest. So no formal arrest or charge so far.
He's being described as a strong person of interest, and he has been arrested in Pennsylvania on gun charges because he was discovered carrying a weapon. But the process of getting him extradited and working with prosecutors here in New York to formally charge him, officials say that will come in time, they believe.
And just remind us of the details of what happened last week with the early morning killing of this healthcare executive.
Yeah, I mean, officials have described it as a brazen and targeted attack in the middle of Midtown last Wednesday morning. This was really just as the CEO, Brian Thompson, was walking in to speak at an investor conference at a Hilton that was right by Rockefeller Center, just a few blocks south of Central Park. And in the video, which has really captured global attention, you see the suspected gunman take aim and very in close range, calmly shoot Mr. Thompson several times before then fleeing. And for many, this is very obviously a rare thing that wouldn't happen in Manhattan every day and more reflective of a Hollywood film. But he went on the loose in this after this five-day manhunt. This is, as you say, the biggest breakthrough yet.
And that was Neda Torfik with that update from New York. Much more about the investigation and the arrest of Luigi Mangione on our website, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. Let's try to look ahead in Syria now. What clues are there as to how HDS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the main rebel group, will lead the government of a new Syria? One big indication might come in how they've tried to run the part of the country that they've held sway over for some years now, and that's Idlib, the city and the province in the north of the country. Rina Netjes is a Dutch journalist and Syria specialist who's based in Turkey but has travelled many times to Idlib in recent years. What are her impressions?
My impression is that very pragmatic and professionals, that they're really trying to serve their people, you know, contrary to Bashar al-Assad. Idlib is full of IDP camps. People keep fleeing to this area despite that it's very strict. Conservative Islamic, it's Islamist, but still people prefer that than living under Bashar al-Assad.
You described the authorities in Idlib as pragmatic, but you also said conservative. Am I right in saying that this is a system of government that is underpinned by Sharia, Islamic religious law?
Yes. Having said that, I see they are developing. They are developing in a less strict way. An example is that in May, I have visited one Christian town and two Christian villages that are in Idlib. What we saw is that they have renovated their churches. Money came from a sister church in Jordan, for example. They are not allowed to put a cross on the church. They're not allowed to ring the church bells at Sunday. But having said that, the church inside looks very nice and they have service every day. You know, you would not have that in Amsterdam, for example, every day a service. So it's really a mixed picture, to be honest.
So there's a certain measure of religious tolerance. I guess one of the other big questions is about whether there is tolerance of dissent, of criticism. And obviously that was something that the Assad dictatorship never brooked the idea of. But from what I've been reading, there have, in the run-up to the astonishing events of the last couple of weeks, there have been a lot of protests in Idlib against what is seen as the sort of the heavy-handed approach to dissent, that a lot of critics have compared the rule of HDS to other authoritarians. How far do you think that is a reasonable picture to paint?
They have been arresting people that demonstrated against them. Having said that, if this would happen in Assad areas, you know, then people would be killed. The demonstrations were like almost in some towns, like every day, and they went on for quite some time. So there is not 100% freedom, but also not 100% authoritarian. Like in Egypt, you could not do this in Egypt or other Arab countries.
Rina Netjes, a Dutch journalist and frequent visitor to Idlib. The astonishing convulsions in Syria have potentially huge ramifications across the Middle East in ways which we can only begin at this point to explore and which we will only begin to understand in the weeks and months to come. We're going to look now at one of the neighbours with a massive interest in the direction Syria takes, and that's Israel. Its military has been attacking suspected sites for chemical weapons and long-range missiles, and tonight, local time, also targeting military airfields inside Syria. It's also moved tanks and infantry into the previously demilitarised buffer zone that runs along the shared border to the outrage, among others, of Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Avraham Levine is a geopolitical analyst at the Alma Centre in Israel. He researches the security challenges on Israel's northern borders. What's his analysis?
I see more challenges than opportunities here. Netanyahu sort of claims a victory here. This is part of the collapse of the Irani radical Shiite axis, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas. So he presents it as a big success. I'd say I see more challenges here. The fact that there was a dictator on the other side of the border is true, and we all agree on that. But is the chaos that we might be facing now better? I'm not sure that's the right thing to think about. What I see is a success of the rebel force. But on the other hand, do they have common goals, common interests, common ideologies? The answer is clearly no. It's on the other side of the border. It's my border. I live 4 kilometers from the Syrian border in the Golan Heights in northern Israel. Instead of seeing an official army with an hierarchy and rules and responsibilities, what I'm facing now is different groups of rebels that I don't know what they're trying to achieve in the next few months.
I guess from what you're saying, it's a fairly short line then to understand why the Israeli military has launched these strikes, heavy strikes against suspected chemical weapons plants, long-range missile sites and so forth, because they obviously don't want any of that getting into unpredictable hands. And there's also been this very controversial, as far as the rest of the region is concerned, push into the demilitarized zone that separates the Golan Heights and Syria. But perhaps it is in Israel's interest that there be a better future for Syria.
I surely hope so. I saw the attempt the previous decade from 2012, 2013 to 2018, and 500,000 people were killed and 6 million refugees and another 5 million displaced in Syria. I surely hope and wish them well. I'm not judging and I'm not taking sides with Assad, of course. He's the butcher from Damascus in their eyes and in our eyes. I'm not choosing sides. I'm just saying that in terms of Israel, as a third party that's not part of this war, we have to be cautious for our interests.
Avraham, you mentioned that you live just 4 kilometers from Syria. You'll be aware that as far as a lot of the world is concerned, the Golan Heights, they may not seem like occupied territory in the same way that the West Bank does, that Gaza does and so forth. But nonetheless, it is officially regarded as occupied territory. And the leader of the main rebel group, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, I mean, the al-Jalani bit of his name in Arabic, it derives from the Golan, where his family came from a couple of generations back. I just wonder whether you think that may become a live issue again.
Syria never gave up on the Golan Heights. That was true from 67, true to today. And as you said, it's about 150-4 every year when we're condemned for holding on to the Golan Heights. When I see a civil war with hundreds of thousands of civilians being killed, when I see militias, Shiite militias led by Iran, jihadists led by Julani, I'm truly happy that we're in the Golan Heights and not them. Because if they were on the Golan Heights, it would be the whole Jordan Valley that would be at risk, because they would have the vantage point in terms of the geography here. I'm extremely satisfied to say the Golan is safe and strong in our hands. If Syria gets their business in order, then that issue will probably come up again.
Avram Levine from the Alma Research Center speaking to me from the Golan. We heard earlier in the program from a young man who got out from one of Syria's most awful prisons. Many are still missing. Many may never be found. There is one man, though, who was last seen back in 2012 and whose family now think that they are tantalizingly close to a reunion. And the particular thing about this case is that it's an American man, the journalist Austin Tice, who was abducted by armed men 12 years ago. His family are convinced he's alive and that the fall of Assad could be the moment he regains his freedom, a message echoed on Sunday by Joe Biden. I've been speaking to Austin's sister, Abby, in Washington, D.C.
What the president said is what we've known all along. Austin is alive and he's in Syria. And right now, it just is such an opportunity for anyone that is currently in Syria to help him get out and come home.
You say you've known all along. I mean, obviously, you've hoped all along, but tell me why you've known all along that Austin is still alive.
We've had various sources tell us that, and especially recently we had a source that's been verified by multiple different government agencies that he is alive, he is being held in good condition, and he is in Syria.
It was what, 2012 when he was abducted? Take me back to then, just how you heard the news and what you understand about sort of the circumstances around his being taken away.
We were actually all together, except for Austin, in a family vacation. And my parents just received a call saying that, you know, hey, we haven't heard from Austin in a couple of days, because he was really good about staying in contact with multiple different people all the time. It kind of snowballed from there. And it's kind of lucky that we were all together in that moment, but also just as horrible as you can imagine.
And remind us what Austin was doing in Syria at the time.
He was there to report on the Syrian conflict, you know, put his life on the line to be one of the only people there at the time to tell what was really going on.
And there was that video of him sort of being taken away blindfolded.
Yes, a lot more has come out about that video since then, but obviously it was extremely hard to watch.
I know that you will be looking forward at right now and hoping this can all be sorted out as quickly as possible. But there were also some hard words said on Friday about the current US administration, about how much they were doing. Tell me about what that has been like over the past 12 years.
I mean, you're always hopeful that your government is going to do everything they can to help a citizen of their country. And we do have people that have been working really hard with us over these past 12 years. But I mean, obviously, he's not home yet. So they have not been successful and they need to keep pushing until they complete their job of getting an American citizen back to America.
And what would your message be to those who know where Austin is and maybe have the power over how quickly he is released?
Right. You know, I would just say, you know, now could be a time to release Austin, get some positive news for Syria. If they have the power to do so, now's the time. Anyone, absolutely anyone there that has the ability to do so, we are just begging them to take advantage of this and reunite the family.
And clearly, the ordeal has been principally for Austin, but it must have been for all your family. You in some way must have had to put your lives slightly on hold this last 12 years.
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, especially my parents, they've just had their lives taken away from them in some capacity as well, because their full focus is on getting Austin home. And anytime the family is all together, there's still an empty hole in our hearts.
Abby Edeburn, sister of the American journalist Austin Tice, still detained in Syria. And shortly before we came on air at the Daily State Department briefing, the spokesman Matthew Miller said that the US hostage affairs envoy Roger Carstens is now in Beirut as part of what he called intensive efforts to find Austin Tice. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. A new Syria is about to be built, that much we know. What we don't know, of course, is how it's going to play out. How much discord, how much harmony. And those three musical metaphors are a rather ploddingly deliberate way into our next voice this hour. The emigre Syrian composer Malek Jandali. He moved to the US in the 1990s, but after the protests against Assad began and then were brutally repressed in 2011, Malek became known as the musician of the revolution. He channeled much of his work into giving a soundtrack to the desire for change in Syria.
What we are witnessing today are truly historical moments. The world and humanity today is in a much better place without such a brutal, ruthless dictator. The Syrian people are for the first time free, celebrating their struggle. You know, they paid a very heavy price for their freedom and dignity. Today, what we are witnessing is a true symphony for peace. People are in the streets chanting as they did in 2012. Chanting for freedom, for peace, and for their country.
And you say symphony for peace, and I guess a lot of people are concerned as to whether, you know, there really is going to be harmony still on the streets of Syria in the coming weeks and months and years, because I guess there must be fears that the examples from elsewhere haven't always pointed in that direction.
That's a very legitimate question, and uncertainty and fear is very legit. However, hope always prevails. Syria is 7,000 plus years old. We are the cradle of civilizations. We always embraced all religions throughout history. We have one of the oldest communities in the world that speak the Aramaic language of Jesus Christ. We have one of the oldest synagogue in Aleppo. And who destroyed these historical UNESCO monuments? The brutal dictator. He is against music, against diversity, against humanity, against children, against justice and freedom and human rights. So fear is legitimate. However, in the last few days, the Syrian people have proven when they returned to their homes and villages, you know, with minimum violence and showing the world that we are a true revolution for dignity, for freedom, and most importantly, for peace in our world.
I know that one of your pieces, I can't quite now remember which of it is, but I was reading the lyrics and it was making very much the point that actually, and it's something that anybody who knows anything about the Middle East will know, that Syria does have a civilization that stretches back thousands of years, because a lot of what has been said about Assad and the Assad family's rule over the last 50 plus years is that they've, so much of modern Syria has been under their brutal grip. But actually, of course, Syria's entire history stretches back vastly further into time.
In my humble opinion, this brutal dictator destroyed the culture of Syria through a very dirty strategy to divide people based on sectarian, based on, you know, evil. But because we are so enriched and so diverse, as a musician, as a composer myself, my duty was to capture that diversity through my symphonies. If I'm going to compose a symphony, which is my symphony number one, titled Syrian Symphony, and all the instruments are going to be performing the same line, it will be the most boring and impactful, you know, music you will ever hear. But that diversity that we have, the counterpoint, the dissonance But all together, we are united in this revolution for dignity and peace in a very harmonious symphony. And that's what the Syrian people has proven. What are we witnessing in the last 48 hours? Unbearable prison cells. People who have been in prison for 40 plus years. That's how brutal this dictator is. Humanity, Tim, is in a much better place today without modern-day Hitler in Syria.
You forged your reputation partly as somebody who provided the soundtrack for protest, for a brief uprising, but then to sort of give people succor during those awful years when any type of protest was so brutally repressed. I guess now, I mean, I wonder whether you think, I mean, clearly I can hear it in your voice, you're completely delighted about the turn of events, but it will provide a new artistic challenge for you to weave that into your work.
Since the start of the revolution, I had 8 symphonies. Prior to the revolution, I had 0 symphonies. 0. And I'm so hopeful that the outcome of this revolution will be a country. Syria was not a country, it was a big jail with no citizens in it. I was not a citizen in Syria. I had no rights. I was a prisoner. Today, the people of Syria are citizens, and hopefully they will have a country with justice, with a order of the law, with human rights.
And Malik, do you imagine that you will be taking your music in person to Syria at some point?
Absolutely. I dream to perform my symphonies at the Opera House, in the streets of Homs, where many of my family members and friends and many people who sacrificed their lives and they were killed. I will go back to give them a voice through the elegant symphonic music to tell the world that we are part of you.
The music and the words of the Syrian composer Malik Jandali, who is speaking to me from New York. He brings this edition of NewsHour to a close from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.